Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Opposing groups in South Sudan's peace process have agreed on an arrangement to allow 1,370 opposition forces in the capital of Juba in preparation for rebel leader Riek Machar to join a transitional government. South Sudan's Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission said in a statement Tuesday that police and military officers loyal to the opposition are expected to travel to Juba immediately. More security forces are expected to join them after the power-sharing transitional government is formed. South Africa's finance minister Wednesday hiked taxes and targeted what he called wasteful and corrupt government spending in a crisis budget aimed at staving off a ratings downgrade of junk status. Africa's most developed economy is struggling with shrinking growth, unemployment running at 25%, and widespread poverty. He said, "We cannot spend money we do not have and cannot borrow beyond our ability to repay," according to Minister Pravin Gordhan speaking to Parliament. "Until we can ignite growth and generate more revenue, we have to be tough on ourselves." He said, "There's no doubt that the fact that we are in a crisis." Uganda's main opposition candidate, Dr. Kizza Besigye, said he has asked his lawyers to challenge in a court of law what he called his continued illegal detention by the police. Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change Party says he has been in and out of police detention since last Saturday without being charged. The opposition leader says he's picked up every morning by police and taken to a police station where he's held until nightfall before being brought back to his residence. You're listening to VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said he spoke to Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov Wednesday and that their teams would meet soon to discuss plans for a planned cessation of hostilities due to go into effect in Syria on Saturday.
I'm not here to vouch that it's absolutely going to work or it's a, you know, but I'm telling you this is the one way that we can end this war. The alternative is that the war gets worse, that Syria might be totally destroyed, not able to be put back together again. Everybody has said you've got to have a diplomatic solution at some point in time. The question will be, is it right? Will Russia work in good faith? Will Iran work in good faith to try to bring about the political transition that the Geneva Communique calls for?
Secretary Kerry's comments come after Syria's President Bashar al-Assad confirmed to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, that Syria is ready to help implement a ceasefire that's planned to begin on Saturday. The two leaders spoke by telephone Wednesday and highlighted the importance of continuing the fight of terror groups such as the Islamic State and Jabhat al-Nusra. Syria and North Korea will come under close scrutiny for rights violations by the 47-member Human Rights Council during its upcoming four-week session, which begins Monday in Geneva. Lisa Schlein reports.
The 47-member UN Human Rights Council will discuss the records of more than 40 countries. It will examine current developments in Burundi following last year's special session on that country's deteriorating situation. The council also will discuss more than 40 reports on universal themes, including torture, summary executions, forced disappearances, religious freedom, and countering terrorism. Among them, a report by the UN Commission of Inquiry on Syria to be submitted on March 15th. New council president Choi Kyung-nim says he expects a very focused discussion on the human rights conditions in Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
One in five children in Africa do not receive basic life-saving vaccines, according to a World Health Organization report Wednesday. The report noted a dramatic rise in child vaccination rates, but said more needed to be done to prevent the spread of diseases such as measles, rubella, and neonatal tetanus. The U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Jordan's King Abdullah II at the White House Wednesday. They had talks that focused on the battle against the Islamic State and the humanitarian fallout from the war in Syria. Jordan has been taking part in the U.S.-led coalition conducting airstrikes against an Islamic State targets in both Iraq and Syria. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wu-Heben. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The turnout is very low. I think it has been a setback from the last presidential elections. I'm not even certain if half of the people who voted last time are coming to vote today.
That's an election observer at a polling station for Uganda's municipal elections. Voter turnout was low despite President Yoweri Museveni urging Ugandans to vote in the elections for mayors and local council members. We have full details coming up.
Also in the news, teams of U.S. and Brazilian health workers have begun efforts to determine if the Zika virus is causing babies to be born with a birth defect affecting the brain.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Uganda held local elections today, 6 days after a tense presidential poll. President Yoweri Museveni has urged Ugandans to vote in the elections for mayors and local council members. But as Elizabeth Pala reports from Kampala, turnout was low and a feeling of uncertainty lingers in the capital.
Unlike the presidential election in Kampala, which was marred by late delivery of voting materials and election day unrest, local elections got off to a mostly smooth start Wednesday. At most voting centers, materials arrived within an hour or two of polls opening, and although minor problems have been reported, for the most part, voters say they're happy with the process. However, polling agents note that voter turnout has been very low. Gloria Paga, an observer at one polling station, says people were demoralized by the presidential vote.
The turnout is very low. I think it has been a setback from the last presidential elections. I'm not even certain if half of the people who voted last time are coming to vote today. Last time the queues were very long, but today you can see practically at this time there's no one on the line. So probably people were disappointed with what occurred in the presidential elections, but we are optimistic.
At one station in Nakasero, nearly 600 people were registered to vote, but only 83 had cast their ballot by noon. One Ugandan named Desmond says he feels intimidated by heavy police presence in the area.
The regime is succeeding at controlling the people's anger and the hope. It's holding people's hopes at bay. Ugandans have accepted that this regime maybe sort of is here to stay. I cannot do anything with it, and unless if I come out to say, you know, to a thing or two, everything of mine will be, you know, gone, and the last thing I'll have in my life is to be lowered to a grave.
Many within Uganda noted the distinct lack of reaction when President Museveni's victory was announced by the Electoral Commission last Saturday. The usually bustling streets of downtown Kampala were deserted, and many worried violence could erupt. Although protests never took place and city life has returned, residents are still uneasy. Such feelings are compounded by the continued house arrest of main Museveni rival Kizza Besigye, with many Ugandans openly wondering how long he'll be held without charges. Besigye has called his detainment illegal and says officials are keeping him from challenging the election results. However, officials in Uganda contend that Besigye's call for protests at the Electoral Commission amount to plans to disrupt public order. They say he has been put under preventative arrest to keep the peace. Elizabeth Pola, for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Uganda's main opposition presidential candidate, Dr. Kizza Besigye, says he has asked his lawyers to challenge his continued illegal detention by the police. Besigye of the Opposition Forum for the Democratic Change Party, FDC, said he has been in and out of police detention since last Saturday without being charged. He said he has been picked up every morning by police and taken to a police station where he is held until nightfall. Police have been stationed outside Besigye's residence since he vowed to lead a protest march against President Yoweri Museveni's election victory. There have been no signs of protests. Besigye says he and Museveni are still candidates in the 2016 election. Under the Constitution, he says either candidate can challenge the results in court, an option he has not ruled out. The 2016 election was the fourth in which Besigye has challenged Museveni. In each election, Besigye went to court to charge vote rigging and lost.
The European Union's biggest hope of stemming the tide of migrants and refugees flooding into Europe depends on a long-term deal with Turkey. Major financial aid offered to Ankara may settle Syrian refugees now in Turkey and welcome thousands more who continue to flee the war in their homeland. VOA's David Arnold reports from Washington.
Europe still struggles with more than a million migrants and refugees. Europe's migrant crisis may get a lot worse and much sooner than officials think, says Dimitrios Papadimitriou. Papadimitriou is the founder of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and a critic of the way the European Union has managed its population crisis.
If Europe does nothing, the only expectation should be that more people will be coming, and there is no reason for the more people not to be 2 million or perhaps 3 million. If Europe and Greece and Italy do not protect Europe's Mediterranean borders, if the agreement with Turkey does not begin to bear fruit, if all of those things happen, then Europe will be overwhelmed, and we don't have to wait until the end of 16. You can expect this to happen certainly by April or May of this year, and you will actually begin to see governments topple.
Greece has served as the accidental and often tragic doorstep to Europe for most of more than a million refugees. Papadimitriou says the European Union has failed to offer the Greek government the aid it needs to control that migration crisis.
Greece is so responsible for some of the things that have come its way, and it practiced what just about every other country between Greece and Germany has practiced, which is around a turnstile where anybody who comes in can find its way to the desirable places, Germany and Sweden. Greece doesn't have the resources. It has a vast maritime set of borders, and without full cooperation of the rest of Europe, Greece simply cannot control those borders.
Hungary and its neighbors have constructed barbed wire fences to stop the flows into their countries, but Papadimitriou says those efforts are short-sighted and bound to fail.
Suppose that the numbers coming through Greece, as they will, because it's going to be spring and the waters are going to be calmer. Suppose that many more people make it to Greece. So what do we do? Fence it, which is what some people in Brussels and member states are talking about. And if we do that, what will Brussels and the other member states do about a complete revolution and breakdown in law and order in Greece? And after that happens, and people no longer want to make it to Greece, I can guarantee you that, they all are going to go back and do what they were doing 2 years ago, which is getting to Italy. Are you going to fence Italy? It's a country of 60 million people, and it has a very large economy. And after you expel Italy out of Schengen, are you going to do the same thing to Spain? This is just the kind of talk and finger-pointing that happens all too easily in Europe.
He says the best hope for the European Union is to commit massive funding to the Turkish government. That funding will pay for several steps to reduce the migrant flow across the Aegean to Greece.
The one that's relatively easy but politically difficult is to basically shut down the smuggling operations. Turkey is a strong state. It has a great administration system. It has, police forces. And now smuggling in Turkey takes place above the ground. So what you need to do is you have to make sure that you attack the smugglers where they hurt. You put them in jail. You take their money away because really, following the money is also a part of this. You make sure that your local officials that are easily bribed, they become very, very wealthy, also go to jail. And you basically try to force the smuggling to go underground. It means that it's going to be costlier for migrants to make it all the way to the Aegean. It also means that they are going to be able to bring people to the Aegean at a much, much, much lower rate. Moving people underground will probably reduce the numbers of people who make it to the coast by about 80%.
Turkey should also encourage refugees of the Syrian war to settle in Turkey, get jobs, and send their children to school. Papadimitriou says more than 200,000 Syrian children have not been able to attend school for years. He calls it a lost generation. The EU has already offered a first payment to Turkey, but how much more will these measures cost Europe?
Massive amounts of money. I, for months now, have been calling the 3 billion euro merely a down payment. Frau Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, called it the first payments. But the alternative is chaos, social upheaval. If we're talking about $10 billion a year, or perhaps even more, for a period of 2 or 3 years, it's a small price to pay in order to do the right thing and the smart thing.
If those displaced by the Syrian war are not given a chance to settle in Turkey, Papadimitriou says Europe will pay a much higher price as more refugees cross the Aegean in the months to come. This is David Arnold in Washington, D.C.
And in more news on migrants in Europe, as many as 3,000 migrants in the northern French port city of Calais are waiting for a judge to decide if they should be evicted from their large campsite. The decision may be made tomorrow. A group of humanitarian associations has asked that the state expulsion be postponed. Most migrants in the camp want to sneak to Britain by ferry or through the Eurotunnel rail service. In neighboring Belgium, the government has restored border controls in anticipation of a flood of evicted migrants. Meanwhile, the French news agency says Portugal has offered to take up 10,000 migrants from countries struggling to cope with the influx to help maintain its own population. Portugal's socialist premier, António Costa, last week sent letters to Austria, Greece, Italy, and Sweden, asking them to send migrants to Portugal. Prime Minister Viktor Orbán of Hungary today has asked the National Election Office to hold a referendum in the European Union's plan for a mandatory quota for the resettlement of migrants and refugees. Mr. Orbán says those voting to reject the proposal would be supporting Hungary's independence. In more news, a German court convicted a Moroccan man of stealing a cell phone and drug possession in the New Year's Eve mob attack at the Cologne railroad station. The 23-year-old held documents claiming he had applied for asylum in the country. He was given a suspended sentence and fined $110. The court stressed that the status and future of the man's asylum application weren't a matter for today's proceedings.
A new study finds that of the 800 peace agreements signed around the globe since 1945, fewer than 15% have addressed natural resources. The report says resources such as oil, gas, timber, and diamonds increasingly are recognized as major factors in armed conflicts. The Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Forest Trends conducted the study. The group says the failure to reform management of natural resources in most countries could help explain why half of all peace agreements collapse within 5 years. Dr. Arthur Blundell is an expert on conflict and natural resource management and co-author of the report. He says natural resources were fueling conflict and war in Africa. He argues that management of natural resources helps to keep peace in the country.
Given our experience monitoring UN sanctions on diamonds and timber in Liberia, we were concerned that a failure to address the role of natural resources in the war, and for the peace that matter, risks allowing the same commodities to fuel the resumption of conflict. It's a problem because not just in these countries, but half of peace agreements fail within 5 years. Many of those are conflicts that involve natural resources because the factions can use either the money or the control of the natural resources to fund resumption of the violence. In fact, conflicts that involve natural resources are twice as likely to fail within 5 years as those that don't. Given the fact that the UN's found a link with natural resources in more than 40% of conflicts since World War II, we just sort of wondered, well, how often do peace agreements even mention natural resources, much less address the governance around these resources in order to break the link in the cycle of conflict?
So do you think that in all of the cases, natural resources, they're deliberately being left out of the peace agreements?
I suspect there's probably different reasons in different cases. Part of the neglect may be strategic. Negotiators simply consider the ceasefire too fraught to deal with a complex issue that's contentious, and so they prefer to leave it to the peace-building phase. They might just be unaware of how important it is to reform how the resources are managed in order to address the grievances that underlie the conflict in the first place, or the way that the resources were used to fund and fuel the war. In other cases, I think it's a tactic where in order to get the parties to the table, you know, just to lay down the weapons in the first place, you need to entice them. And so in some cases, the negotiators use natural resources as, you know, war booty to entice the parties to the table. And then in other cases, it may be more cynical where commercial interests They don't want to hamstring the exploitation of natural resources once the war itself stops.
So how do you get countries to include natural resources in peace talks, in the beginning of the peace talks?
For example, in Liberia, the UN sanctions were the leverage, I think, you know, forced through the reforms that were necessary. Not every country has that leverage. Then it's going to be more important for the rest of the participants in the peace process, the donors and other partners, to put the pressure on the factions to make sure that they really do address it. You know, we as consumers in the international community, especially with globalization, using the resources from places like Africa.
So can you explain a little bit more about what happened with Liberia?
So Liberia is a great case because it is a case of both natural resources driving the war and then the importance of getting it right during the peace process afterwards. The Liberia Truth and Reconciliation Commission documented really clearly how rebel groups fought to control areas rich in resources, either to exploit them themselves or to extort taxes from the miners and the loggers. And then they used that money to buy guns and pay fighters. In some cases, the logging companies themselves trafficked in weapons, other war material. And then President Taylor's government forced the logging companies to employ his former militia commanders as company security. And it's alleged that those militias forcibly displaced and looted and committed mass atrocities. You know, there's a really strong case to be made for the link between resources and the war, which contributed to a sense of grievance within Liberia and provided the money and material to restart the war. Because of this role that they had in fomenting the resumption of the armed conflict, the UN Security Council sanctioned the international trade in diamonds and timber. And it was interesting that they wanted to highlight the role the international community played in this. And so the sanctions were actually on the import of timber from Liberia, not the export of timber from Liberia. It was to highlight the role we had in Liberia's conflict. But then, despite all this attention within the Security Council, when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2003, it only mentions natural resources in terms of divvying up control among the warring parties. So one of the rebel groups was given control of the Mines Ministry and the Forestry Ministry during the transitional government. So there was nothing in the peace agreement about the necessity to reform the governance of the resources. But fortunately, the Security Council maintained the sanctions during the transition phase, and that sanctions helped provide the leverage to actually get the governance reform in place. And so then Liberia undertook a pretty intensive package of reforms that, while it hasn't been perfect, have made sure that the TRC had documented are not being done now. And so I think that it may be a large part of why Liberia has been able to avoid a return to war that affects more than half of other countries that are in a similar position. More than half of peace agreements fail within 5 years. Liberia has now been more than a decade.
I also just wanted to briefly touch on climate change and how that further impacts conflicts in the coming years and how it can be used in climate change negotiations to manage natural resources.
Climate change is going to change existing patterns of resource use as well, so that'll just potentially exacerbate conflicts. I think the link with climate change and peace negotiations is through just the international role of the international partners. And again, globalization is also changing that. We have to make sure that the international community takes seriously the governance of natural resources. And I think part of it is not looking at it as an environmental issue, but looking at it as a peace and security issue.
Dr. Arthur Blundell is an expert on conflict and natural resource management and co-author of the report. He spoke with us from New Orleans, Louisiana.
South Sudan's Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission has said that police and military officers loyal to the opposition party are expected to travel to Juba immediately. More than 1,300 opposition forces of former rebel leader Riek Machar are expected, as Machar, now first vice president, assumes office in a power-sharing transitional government. After 2 years of civil war, Machar and South Sudan President Salva Kiir signed a peace deal in August. Kiir appointed Machar as his first vice president last week in the first step towards forming the unity government. However, despite the moves towards solidarity, fighting continues in parts of South Sudan. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is due in Juba tomorrow to meet with Kiir and visit a UN shelter for civilians that has been affected by the conflict.
Ankara this week joined an international working group to resolve the Libya crisis. The move follows the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan giving the green light for ministerial bilateral contacts. Since the 2013 military overthrow of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, Ankara suspended relations with Egypt. Dorian Jones reports.
This week, Ankara welcomed Cairo's participation in an international working group to resolve the crisis in Libya. The move followed reports Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has authorized renewing contacts with Egypt at a ministerial level. Diplomatic relations were cut after Egypt's military deposed President Mohamed Morsi, a close ally of Erdogan. Political columnist Semih Yediz of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper and the Al Monitor website notes a move to repair ties with Egypt and other Middle Eastern countries follows a deterioration in Turkey's relations with all of its southern neighbors and Russia.
The isolation it has found itself in the Middle East is forcing it to try and reestablish some links that it had before.
Ankara's relations with Saudi Arabia have markedly improved under the new Saudi ruler, King Salman. The two countries are closely coordinating their support of the Syrian rebels. International relations expert Soli Özel of Istanbul's Kadir Has University says Turkey's steps toward a rapprochement with Egypt are tied to its improved relations with Saudi Arabia.
Turkey cannot increase its intimacy with Saudi Arabia and keep a very inimical relation with Egypt, which is being financed by Saudi Arabia. Remember that the common enemy for those three countries is Iran.
Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt are all concerned Iran's power in the region will grow now that international sanctions against it have been lifted. The three leaders will have a chance to meet face-to-face at the next Islamic summit set to take place in Istanbul in April. Ediz says Erdogan is aware the idea of warming up to Egypt is a sensitive subject inside the Turkish president's ruling AKP party, given the Egyptian government's treatment of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood.
A full rapprochement at a time like this, I think, will not be received well by the ruling AKP's Islamist grassroots supporters.
But Cairo's hardline stance against Gaza is also seen as a complicating issue, given Ankara's strong backing of Gaza's Hamas government. Özel says the fate of former Egyptian President Morsi, who is facing a death sentence, is key.
If they hang Morsi, I'm sure it will be very difficult to sustain this revitalization of relations.
Analysts suggest Erdogan is pushing for commuting the death sentences against Morsi and his followers, and possibly a full amnesty for them, as the price Egypt must pay to restore diplomatic relations with Turkey. But with Ankara close to an agreement with Israel, another estranged former ally, it appears ready to compromise to end its isolation. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
The Voice of America, VOA.